RUF listeners, allow me to take a minute for some shameless self-promotion as I plug my new novel, The Locker Notes. It's a shameless, brutal, yet sentimentally heartfelt tale of rock and roll suburbia during the 1970s. A comedy about the absurdities of early childhood, friends, enemies, peer pressure, drugs, politics, pathetic school crushes, and a whole lot of rock and roll. Rock and roll, rock and roll. The Locker Notes unfold before the backdrop of the music, movies, television, fashion, sports, and world events of the 1970s, all seen through the eyes of a child during simpler yet turbulent times that are marked by an ever-present sense that something inevitably horrible is just around the corner. The Locker Notes. Every generation lives at the end of the world. Available through Amazon and everywhere else online, wherever books are sold.
So our Rock Under Fire audience is going to be happy about this one. Original cast member Stick Nixon joining us.
Yahoo!
Yeah. Well, I specifically wanted to talk about music from the elder. Now, because I edit... Our listeners can't see this. We're recording this on video, so only you can see this. I'm holding this up. This is my original copy of The Elder. I got this for Christmas in 1981, and being a wise-ass, stupid kid at the age of 11, I wanted people to think that they autographed it for me, so I copied their signatures somewhere on here. Where is it now? So I wrote on the cover on here somewhere.
Now let me ask you a question. Had you not done that, would that particular vinyl be valuable because that's the original?
No, because there are a lot of copies of The Elder out there. And, you know, I mean, you and me and the guys from Three Sides of the Coin are the only people on the planet that bought it.
Yeah, and, but I mean, so, still, if that's an original, doesn't it have a different label in the middle? You always tell me that the original Casablancas have like the black label on it.
Not that I know of, man. This is mine. It's got the hand on it.
Yeah, that's the real deal. I mean,
you could go to a Kiss convention, or you could go to a Kiss expo and get an original copy of the originals for $25. You know, the Elder is not going to be that pricey. There's copies out there, man.
So like a valuable Kiss vinyl would be like the first album.
I mean, you could get the first, very first Kiss record with the one that doesn't have Kiss and Time on it for a relatively cheap price. You know, the Kiss vinyl is not, you know, unless it's extremely rare, man. It's Kiss vinyl's not that pricey, man. And this one here is, this is my new copy. This is the 2014 remaster that has the original running order. So I don't know how much you know about the history of The Elder, but it starts with fanfare. It starts with the orchestration, whereas, you know, we're so used to hearing the Oath.
Right.
And then that little... Well, that's how the record opens. So that's how it was originally intended to open. Goes into Just a Boy. Let me read this. Let me read the original sequencing, and then we'll get into a little Elder discussion.
Yeah.
The original sequencing. All right. Well, let's go. All right. The sequencing that we do, right, that we grew up with, is The Oath, right? And I'm just doing this from. Because the original record has the sequencing on it, right? So I'm just going from memory. All right. We were raised with The Oath, Fanfare, Just a Boy, Dark Light, Only You, Under the Rose, and that was side one. Side two was A World Without Heroes, Mr. Blackwell, Was Odyssey before Escape from the Island, or was it after Escape from the Island?
I couldn't tell you for certain, bro.
Yeah. All right. So it was Odyssey, Escape from the Island. One of them, I'm not sure which came before the other. And then it was I. All right. So the original running order, which they released on the remasters, was Fanfare, goes into Just a Boy, Odyssey, Only You, Under the Rose, Dark Light, World Without Heroes, The Oath, Mr. Blackwell, Escape from the Island, and I. So
that's how the album reads as a coherent story if you're thinking about it.
That's how it was originally intended. That is the what they presented to the label.
And if I'm being honest, I never thought much about the story. I've always enjoyed the songs. I never like looked at it like chronologically. Does this make any sense? I never like put that much thought.
Yeah, because well, that's another thing is if we go back to the 80s now, for a little context for our listeners, people may know that you and me go back literally to the earliest possible childhood that we were literally shitting our diapers together.
Yes,
and our parents grew up together and went to school together and did a lot of stuff together, you know, long before we existed, man.
Nothing has come between us, not even girls.
The thing is, and correct me if I'm wrong, man. All these years, I don't recall us, and we lived every Kiss record in real time, going back to Alive. You know, I discovered Kiss on Alive. Alive was the new album when I discovered them, all right? And they went through Destroyer, and then finally, about, it took a year, but I finally got my first Kiss record in early 77, Rock and Roll Over. It was the current record. Calling Dr. Love was on the radio. But all the way back, man, all the conversations, everything, all the concerts, I don't recall us ever having a single conversation about The Elder. You know, correct me if I'm wrong. I remember you had the outtakes. I don't remember if we ever really talked about how we felt about the album, though, man. You know, there was no tour. If I'm not mistaken, did you skip that record? Did you pass on it and hear it much later?
Like, yeah, well, my trajectory with the band's a little bit different, man. You know, I kind of jumped ship after Dynasty for a little while. I still remember being in the store, and I bought Dynasty and loved it. But I remember being in the store at my dad buying the Atari 2600, and I see the new Kiss album Unmasked sitting there. And for the first time in my life, I don't care. You know, and I didn't come back, honestly, to Animalize. I had to get into Unmasked, The Elder, and Creatures of Night, look it up retroactively, man. So I bailed for a couple years. And that's interesting, man. I mean, you hear a lot about how, obviously, I wasn't alone. A lot of Kiss fans jumped ship, supposedly because of the different musical direction they took. But that wasn't my motivation. I think I was just of a certain age and I changed. I was getting into like Rush and Judas Priest. I don't know, man. I think that they make too much of that, the change in direction and how fans abandoned them. You know, so many of us were just young boys when we got into Kiss and we grew in a different direction past the age of 10, maybe. I know that was my case. I loved Dynasty. So there was no reason I shouldn't want Unmasked, but I just started getting into other bands and different things.
I think a lot of that, and they do make a lot of it, a lot of that pertains to the people that were older than us. Again, for context, Stick and I are born in 1970. So when Kiss first comes out, those first fans that are actually going to the concerts who are already 18, 19, 20 years old, who are already 10 years older than us, we were that generation. We were those kids going to the Dynasty shows where by the time of Dynasty and they're complaining about the little kids starting to show up, we were those little kids, right? So
that is true, man. Yeah. You know what? You're right. The original fans, man.
So like, when Dynasty came out, we didn't look at Dynasty as, oh, they've gone disco or what is this crap? To us, it was just the new Kiss album.
Yeah.
It was a new Kiss record. It was great. We were, you know, I mean, I didn't rush to the store. I got it for Christmas. It took me about 6 months to get it. But I remember, you know, Dave Nolan playing it on his cassette. He had a little one of those little Radio Shack cassette recorders. And we would sit in the backyard and play with the Fisher-Price Adventure people, and we would listen to Dynasty. all summer, 1979. So by the time I got it for Christmas, I mean, I knew it inside out. But I got off the boat, the bus, the train, whatever you want to call it, you know, for Unmasked. The locker notes, when you read the locker notes, you'll get a kick out of that because your story about Unmasked and how you didn't give a shit. You'll find the locker notes pretty interesting because there's a little segment about Unmasked and how we, you know, the character, I say we, but yeah, you know, it's loosely based on real people. It's a, you know, the memoir written as a novel, you know, as our friend Robert Duncan did with Loudmouth last year. So, yeah, I did get off the bus for about a year. I don't remember. I think it was just a case of not knowing Unmasked was out. And it was just, I mean, I saw it at the St. Rocco's Feast, you know, the carnival. And I saw it up there.
Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Yeah, where you shoot the water into the clown mouth and pop the balloon and you try to win a record, you know, and you spin the number or whatever it is. But I remember seeing it. I was like, whoa, what is that? And I didn't really care. I remember a couple weeks before seeing Kiss at the Palladium on TV. The news, ABC News, was showing Kiss was playing the small club and they were breaking in their new drummer. And, you know, I remember it as vividly. I was 10 years old, but I remember it. And not really thinking too much about it. It's like, ah, Peter Criss is gone, you know, and it was just wasn't the same. You know, I already had a sense of, I don't know about this. And then I'm going to skip the Elder for a second. When we get the Creatures, I remember we were being the carpool for CCD that night. And I think it was either your mom or somebody's mom was picking me up. And I remember I didn't want to leave because Kiss was going to be on a show called PM Magazine, or not PM Magazine, one of those tabloid shows. And they were talking about Kiss is currently got this new guy, Vinny Vincent. And he's, you know, and I'm like, huh? You know, so at that point, I never liked I Love It Loud. I people that know me know that I've got very, very unpopular opinions of Creatures of the Night. I think it's just painfully, ridiculously overrated. I think it's get this revisionist history over the past 10 years that it's this important Kiss record that it returned them to form. And you know, they were, I think it was just they said there was a three record left turn where they were trying to find themselves, an identity crisis, a pop record, the so-called disco record, and then the you know, the concept album, and then the creatures returned them to, I don't think they returned to anything. I think they just kept going in that left turn, and they got heavy for the sake of being heavy, jumping on the metal trend. I don't think Kiss ever returned to Kiss again, because they basically went from playing Chuck Berry chords to playing bar chords, power chords, went from single drum to double bass drum. It was a whole different thing. So, but somewhere, yeah, I mean, I just wanted nothing to do with Creatures of the Night especially once I found out that Ace was no longer in the picture. So back to the Elder. The funny thing is in between, I see the commercial for the Elder. I see it was around the holidays. It was somewhere in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. I was like, oh, that looks weird. What is that? Didn't mention it. Didn't ask for it. I got it. It showed up. I had it as a present for Christmas, 1981. I loved it. It's, you know, I absolutely adore the Elder to this day, man. It played the shit out of it. It was, I didn't think like, oh, they sold out, or what are they trying to do? This is Kiss, this is pussy, this is, it should rock more. I didn't think any of that. I was just like this. I remember thinking, wow, it's weird, but I like it. You know, what else is an 11-year-old going to think?
I think it's fantastic, man, to this day. And maybe this whole idea that Kiss fans hate it is overblown too. I think a shitload of Kiss fans really do love it.
Yeah. You know, I just,
am I wrong?
it's I mean, our issues, I'm sure with Kiss fans, I mean, look, I mean, I love, we're both lifelong fans. You know, we go back. I mean, we bought the records, we lived the records and the tours in real time. The issues I have with not all fans, but with a lot of fans are all over the place. I'm not going to get into that. There are other podcasts that do that where they just go off on the fans and just, I mean, obviously the war. I mean, Kiss fans are just like so tribal. Like, you got your Vinnie fans. You have your Eric Carr fans, and you're just kind of, you know, you have your the original Kiss and only the original Kiss. Yeah. Every other version, you know. My thing with the makeup, you know, I've gotten over it. I think it's sacrilege, but I've gotten over it. Kiss is the band that exists today. I'm rooting for them. I hope they finish this tour. You know, I love Paul, man. I follow him on Twitter. I see Paul. I'm more in touch with Paul just through Twitter, not personally, but just seeing what he posts and just having a sense of Paul Stanley. Every day, what was Paul doing today? Oh, he's riding his bike, or today he's cooking some pasta, or he always checks in on Twitter. He lets you know what he's doing, where he is.
He's pretty active too, is he not?
Gene's just been running his mouth on various different things. You know, I don't know. I don't follow Gene on Twitter. I don't know if he posts or what he does, but Paul is very active. So my point is that no, I didn't. I mean, you know, I didn't support the. Tommy and Eric using Ace and Peter's makeup, you know, but like I said, I got over it. It is what it is. I'd rather have these guys out there than not have them out there, but it gets to a point where, you know, these guys are in their early to mid 70s now. Obviously none of these bands are going to be around in 5 to 10 years. We're much closer to the end than we ever were for a lot of bands. You know, we're going to be living in a world very soon where there's no Rolling Stones. You know, where there's no living Beatles, you know, I'm rooting for them. I'm rooting for them to finish this tour.
You know, the Rolling Stones, the fact that the Stones are still doing it is astonishing, but even they don't have to put on 7-inch heels and makeup and walk around.
Yeah. And Gene always has a good point when he brings that up.
And how and why are they doing that in their 70s, dude? That blows my fucking mind, dude. But, I can't even.
Part of me wants to, like, name this episode "Why the Elder Rules and Why Kiss Fans Suck." And I'm just like, okay, we're really gonna ruffle feathers with that. But you know what? Kiss fans suck for letting Paul and Gene and Ace get away with trashing this album for 40 years. That an album that they should otherwise be proud of for simply having the balls to do it. The type of album that nobody who ever trashed them as a band believed they could do. You know, the type of album that critics never thought they could do. You know, it's the type of album that only prolific artists with balls do. You know, it's the type of album that challenges your audience no matter how much you think it might piss them off or alienate them. It's just that same thing when Bob Dylan went electric, or Springsteen went acoustic, or Prince changed his name to a symbol, or Metallica worked with Lou Reed, or Stravinsky, you know, presents The Rite of Spring in 1907.
I don't know why they don't own it, man. And at the end of the day, how can you listen to World Without Heroes, The Oath, Dark Light, and say this album sucks? I mean, they're great songs.
If The Elder, on the same exact merits that it's been judged by Paul and Gene and so many fans, if on those same exact merits it succeeded on the pop charts and got nothing but praise from the critics, Paul and Gene would still be beating their chest over it today. They'll be enforcing it as this masterpiece. You know, they'd be boasting about it as this courageous move instead of a misstep.
You know? What I like, dude, because their whole opinion is based on the reception to it and not the actual content. If their critics loved it and it was their Sergeant Pepper, like they said, it would be a whole different story. You're right.
Yeah, you know, it's
I wonder what the tour would have looked like. What would the stage have looked like, man?
Well, you know, it's like Paul's a delicate flower, man. You know, I love the guy all the more for it, but he never got over that first negative wave of press in the early days. And the more that the critics and the press, they just piled on for those first 6 or 7 years, that they were a joke band, that they weren't a real band, that they can't play their instruments. that resentment, man. He wears it on his sleeve to this day.
Not like that, bro. Do you remember like some of his stage raps in the 80s? He would talk about it when people say Kiss sucks to the crowd. Oh, fuck that.
Yeah, you know, the fuck Michael Jackson stuff. And, you know, he does not try to hide that.
I don't know why they let them see people, they let them see them sweat, man. Because
he needs to let that go, man. And a lot of that has to do with why to this day he feels that if somebody brings up the Elder, to this day, it's almost like he's almost feels obliged to trash the album. Almost like, yeah, we did this. We know. Yeah, Club, please. But it's really the other way around. There are people, I mean, like likewise with first generation Kiss fans, you know, there's like a damaged child in many first generation Kiss fans that carries that same resentment for decades, you know, that just like that they're almost like there's like this like healing pride where in people being able to say that they watched their band go the distance. You know, it's like that same type of resentful pride that compels some of my favorite Kiss podcast that they use as their social media signature. They say, forget the haters. We won, you know, and that's basically just saying that Kiss, we went the distance, man. We watched our band go the distance in the face of all these fucking haters and critics, man. I just think that like a lot of fans trash it because they feel like they're supposed to. You know, does that make sense? It's like they feel they're supposed to trash it. They feel like if they don't trash it, they're not in line with what the real Kiss fans say. There's always the real Kiss fans. That's the thing. It's like I don't know of any other band. I cannot think of any other band that has fans that judges other fans on whether they're a real fan.
Yeah.
You know? It's like almost like a sports team. It's like you're not a real Yankee. Yeah. It's just like it's like almost sports like.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, look, the fact is that the album is their boldest and most daring work. And it's probably, look, realistically, it's the only interesting thing they've ever really done to go against the predicted and accepted grain. You know, it's too bad, you know, because it's 40 years. And, you know, that we were celebrating, and I say celebrating, man. We're celebrating this record. Again, people, I'm holding this up. People, I'm holding the Elder up to the camera, and you're not gonna see it.
But, man, what are the chances they'll do the Elder in its entirety before they completely retire? They should just do it on a Kiss cruise.
I was just gonna say that, man. You know, it's just too bad, man, because you know they really missed a great chance to blow a lot of minds on this recent Kiss crew with it. And they missed that chance, man. They didn't blow any minds. They just blew it. That's just my opinion. I don't go on the Kiss cruise. I never have. I most likely never will. It's not for me. It's I get seasick in a rowboat, you know, in a paddle boat.
That's true.
I got sick at Barrington Lake. But it's just too bad that this is an album that I you know, I love the album just as much today as I did when it came out. It's you know, and we've always distinguished between best and favorite. What is Kiss's best album? Well, you know, it's always arguable what Kiss's best album is. You know, it's if you say Destroyer and I say Rock and Roll Over, if you say Hotter Than Hell and I say, you know, whatever, you know, I always say Rock and Roll Over Hotter Than Hell as far as studio albums. Everyone is arguable. Destroyer is arguably their best studio album. Rock and Roll Over is arguably their best studio album. Hotter Than Hell is arguably their best studio album. You know what I mean? It's like, take your pick of the first.
I wouldn't argue what you said anyway. Right. Yeah.
But man, I always distinguish favorites, man. And this album, Music from the Elder, is I would say it's probably in my top three or four favorites of even the first six. I probably play it more than half of the first six. I play The Elder just as much as I play Rock and Roll Over. I play it just as much as Hotter Than Hell. I play it just as much as Dynasty. You know, I love Dynasty, by the way, too, man. I mean, Dynasty is solid. I love Dynasty, man. People are nuts. People are fucking insane, his fans, man.
All the people that hate The Elder, do they really think Animalized is better? Do they think Crazy Nights is better? I mean,
what do you think? What do you think about those albums, man?
I think those albums. I don't like those albums, dude. I got back into Kiss during Animalized, but
sure. I was there with you, man.
Come on, sucks. And Crazy Nights sounds ridiculously dated.
Yeah, it's Crazy Nights. That's one of the
Bruce Kuhl.
Well, Bruce, I think you and I have always viewed Bruce Kulick a little differently. I've always kind of championed Kulick. Bruce Kulick, I think, has single-handedly become the caretaker of 80s Kiss music. And more power to him for that, because there are a lot of 80s Kiss fans, a lot of people that got on board for the first time in the 80s. So a lot of people I remember in high school, people I literally thought Get Up was their first album. Like, who's this band Kiss? You know, like literally where they didn't listen to music in the 70s because they were just too young. And, we'd be hypocrites to say that we thought it sucked back then, because a lot of that stuff we thought was really great back then.
I love Crazy Nights when it came out.
We counted the months till Crazy Nights came out.
Yeah, we did, dude. I did love it.
Well, it did not age well. I think there are things I cringe on Crazy Nights when I hear, and there are things that I'll go take to my grave, saying that, you know, I'll Fight Hell to Hold You is probably single-handedly Paul's hands down greatest vocal performance on any recorded studio track, so much so that I never, not once ever attempted it live, as far as I know. You know,
my favorite Paul vocal is Take Me Away Together as one.
I was going to say, I would put that a very close second.
Yeah.
And either or. I think, you know, one or the other. Those are my two, I think, Paul's strongest vocal performances. But I guess the point, more to the point, is that there is an entire generation of 80s fans that will take those records, man, Look It Up, and Creatures, and Asylum and Animalized over the 70s stuff any day. A lot of people that were raised on, it's like when we say, okay, we will take 70 Stones over 60 Stones. That is safe enough. Is that accurate with you? Because I love 70s Stones more than 60 Stones. And then you have a lot of Brian Jones purists who say, well, the Stones died when Brian Jones died, you know? And
gun to my head, yeah, it's not a clear and obvious, though. Like, oh, yeah, 70s is better. It's not that obvious.
No, but it's our preference. It's our preference.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, probably. So probably.
It's like almost the same thing where, like, the Stones were huge in the 60s, man. But, I mean, I can't imagine. I can't relate to the mindset that would take 60s Stones over 70s Stones. And to me, that's just totally foreign. It's like a foreign concept, because I'm so attached to Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street and Goathead Soup. Now think of somebody, and these people have to exist, and we've talked about this in some other episode. These people have to exist, man. People that didn't discover the Stones until like Undercover or Dirty Work, you know, there's got to be some people out there on this planet that prefer 80s Stones, man. Or even, you know, like Voodoo Lounge, or like people that got on board on the Steel Wheel Tour.
I mean, it wasn't on my radar until I saw the Start Me Up video, like in 1982. Honestly, man,
they were on mine. They were on mine. Hot Rocks was one of my toys as a kid. I used to play with it. I didn't know what it was, but it was always in my hand.
Yeah,
I always had Hot Rocks in my hand when I was 4 years old. So, I kind of knew a lot of Stones music by the time Tattoo U came out. There are Kiss fans that prefer the 80s. That's my point. That was just my bigger point, is that there are a lot of Kiss fans that prefer the 80s. And what Bruce Kulick does, man, the importance of Bruce Kulick within the entire big picture of Kiss is he goes on these cruises. And these cruises are big events for like the diehards, the people that can afford it, the people that are willing to part with thousands of dollars each year and go on this cruise, man. And this is like this is like the like New Year's Eve and Halloween and the 4th of July all rolled into one. You know, yeah. It's 3, 4 days, 5 days, whatever it is. And there's all these bands, and all these bands go on, like a lot of bands from the 80s that don't do as well as Kiss anymore. They're on, like, the Night Ranger was on the cruise this year.
I didn't realize that. They have guest bands?
Yeah, Cheap Trick was on it 2 years ago. I think Rat was on one of them, maybe the current one or maybe the one before it. If I'm not mistaken. But Bruce Kulick goes on, man. Bruce Kulick's been a guest on at least the last three, maybe the last four. And he brings his own band, and he just plays for an hour and a half, and he goes through everything from Lick It Up through Revenge. And people are loving it, man. It's just the people that are deprived of that stuff because Gene and Paul won't play it. So they're up there, man, and they're playing, King of the Mountain. They did King of the Mountain on the last one from 2019. They're up there doing Who Wants to Be Lonely and this stuff from Asylum and stuff from Animal Eyes and Crazy Nights. You know, he's even doing Vinny stuff. Like he opened with Exciter this year.
And it's generally Gene and Paul's policy to ignore that era now, huh?
It's not that they ignore it. Well, they do ignore it in the set list. I think the issue is because, you know, Paul always says that they only have 20 songs in the set list or whatever it is. If you have 20 songs in a set list, I don't know if it's 20 or 25 or 22. I don't know what it is. But, you know, Paul's thing is, well, what songs are you going to take out? You know, if we're going to play She's So European, what do you take out? Detroit Rock City, Love Gun, Black Diamond, you know, what do you take out? Shout It Out Loud.
Isn't that the idea of the Kiss cruise, though, to play cuts like She's So European?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's, I mean, like I said, I don't go on the, I wouldn't, I don't have, you know, I just would never go on the cruise. I don't go on any cruise. But I like to check in with, you know, when they're doing it, when I know the cruise is going on, I check YouTube immediately just to see, well, what's Bruce Kulick going to do this year? Bruce Kulick is the real, I hate to say it, but Bruce Kulick for the last 3 years has been the real star of the Kiss cruise. And the fans know it too. I don't know if there's many fans that would disagree with on that. You know,
and it's a lot of cool stuff comes up in my newsfeed on my phone with Kulick. Like, he is like the archivist for like the whole 80s era.
He is, like I said, he's become the caretaker of 80s Kiss.
Yeah,
you know, that's and again, more power to him, man, because there's a whole generation of Kiss fans that prefer that stuff, man, that were not old enough when we were going to see the Asylum shows, man, and the Crazy Night shows in the 80s. They were younger, so they saw heaven. It's like, all right, case in point, man. Chris Jericho, the wrestler, and he's got that band Fozzy. Okay, as far as I know, his first memory of Kiss was seeing Heaven's on Fire on MTV. Now, he's slightly younger than us. Right. So that was his Kiss, man. That was his version of Kiss. And he'd so much so that he made a cover band. It was just a cover project during the shutdowns last year where they went and recorded stuff like No, No, No.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, there's just a bunch of people in music, just like slightly younger than us, that treasures 80s Kiss, man.
Yeah, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around listening to Animal Eyes and Asylum, though, and being like, oh, fuck yeah, this is the greatest.
Well, that's because we're older and we're first generation fans. It was what it was. We lived through it. We liked it then. I mean, look, I remember a time where we thought that, again, when I say that people hate the elder because they think they're supposed to, there was a period where in the 80s, and you might disagree, but I think you might agree. In the 80s, I think you were slightly, I don't want to say slightly, I think you were much more into Kiss in the 80s than I was at the time. You really like got back into them full force. You got in with the merchandise, and you were going to the convention. I was going to the convention with you, but you were spending the thousands of dollars on that stuff. You were coming back with pinball machines and, you know, all kinds of rare stuff, man. I mean, you had the pinball machine in your bedroom, you know?
Guilty as charged, man. And I really did love Asylum and Crazy Nights when they came out back then. Yeah. I did.
So we traveled. We traveled around. It was not even the tri-state area. We went up to Boston for the very first Kiss convention, March of 87. So, but I remember there was a period where I did not like certain things. I hated War Machine. I cannot stand War Machine to this day. It's it was boring 4 minutes of my life every time they play War Machine. Again, I'm very unpopular when it comes to the Creatures album. I remember not liking Fits Like a Glove, and I remember like being terrified to tell you that I didn't like Fits Like a Glove. Like, we used to do Kiss concerts in your bedroom with the tennis rackets and the fake guitars, and we used to jump off the bed and light the smoke. And it's like, oh, fuck. We got to do Fits Like a Glove. People Fits Like a Glove in the set list again. So I used to pretend to like certain Gene songs from the 80s, and I can never stand like No. Well, No, we were already too old. But, you know, there was that period where we were just like, are we getting too old for this shit? Like, that was around like the Animalize tour, because we were like already like 12. Or 13 or 14,
listeners don't know, you should clarify that the Kiss concerts are when we're literally pretending to be Kiss with tennis rackets in our hand and me squirting ketchup out of my mouth and the strobe lights on in my bedroom. Yeah, until we reached a certain age where we grew out of it.
Yeah. I think everybody did that. I don't know there's many Kiss fans that would not admit to that. I think people, you know, if you were a real Kiss fan in the 70s, you did Kiss concerts, man. You took tennis rackets, you took horse heads on broomsticks, you took wooden spoons, you took whatever it was that you could use as a guitar, man. You stood on your bed and you jumped off your bed and you pushed the bed to the side of the wall so you had more floor space. You used as a stage. You did all that. Come on. More people would, you know, how many Kiss fans are going to admit to doing that back in the day? Mike Granvold, Tommy Summers, you guys did that. You know you did that.
I tell you what, though, man, it is one of the most interesting eras of the band. Someone does have to write a book, man, from like Unmasked, The Elder, and Creatures in the Night. Like, that whole period would be, yeah, a really detailed book about that. I need it up. I'd love it.
You know, there was a guest speaking of Three Sides. One of my favorite to this day, one of my favorite Three Sides episodes is when Chuck Klosterman, the shows that Chuck Klosterman was on.
I've never read him. I got to get his book.
He said something I very, very much think about all the time I'm always interested in the lowest periods of bands, the periods where people think they suck, man, where they lose it, where they lose the ball, where they lose their focus, where they lose who they are. They go through a period of like some sort of an identity crisis. How are we going to redefine ourselves? Should we do this to please this group? Should we do that to please the critics? What are we doing? What's our next move? The low points of a band. And so to go through that 3-album phase of Dynasty where they're, you know, they were still huge for Dynasty, man. But through Unmasked, and The Elder, I'm always interested in these periods, man. And yeah, somebody should do. I mean, look, there is a book. There's a guy, Julian Gill, who does the FAQ, the Kiss FAQ in a podcast called, it's the Kiss FAQ podcast. And he's written a few books on Kiss. He wrote a book on Crazy Nights. He's got an entire book on Crazy Nights. He's got an entire book on The Elder. So there are publications out there.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
I know in Paul's book, man. Yeah, I just love like the Creatures era, like how depressed he was. Like he couldn't get out of bed, flicking the guitar pick in the crowd and fly over the whole crowd, losing that woman he was in love with to Dan Aykroyd. And he was just suicidally, morbidly depressed. Yeah, that whole dark.
Donna Mills, yeah.
Yeah.
I listen. It's funny that you say that because I listen to the audio book on YouTube a lot. Just when I'm like in just hanging around or doing whatever, I have to always be listening to something. And if I'm going through YouTube, I always see Paul's book on there. I love the audiobook because it's like, it's very rare that you, I think you said it, it's very rare that you see the author actually reading their own book.
Yeah.
On the audiobook.
It's a good job of it too.
Well, anyway, so that's, I think we, I don't know. I think I said my piece on The Elder. I think Paul and Gene need to seriously. Yeah, and another thing about The Elder, if you remember, I don't know if you remember, but that there was supposed to be a film, man. There was supposed to be The Elder film. And somebody finally asked, of all these years, somebody finally asked Gene a few weeks ago on the cruise, when's the movie coming out? And he's like, I don't think it's ever coming out. But he did mention this one thing that I didn't know about until recently. He said that there was supposed to be a movie. And Chris Makepeace, the kid from Meatballs and My Bodyguard
was supposed to
be, he was supposed to be in it. Now, I don't know if you've ever noticed, I might be, unless I'm crazy, man, I always wondered most of my life why he's mentioned in the credits.
Is he on the credits on the album he's mentioned?
He's mentioned somewhere. I don't know where he's mentioned, but he's mentioned somewhere. Let me just really quick look at this.
Yeah, man.
Yes, he's mentioned right on the back of the album, like right here. On the back sleeve of the album, he's mentioned. So now, me being me, you know, I've always been a film buff since a very, very early age. So in 1981, 82, I knew that name. I knew Christopher Makepeace.
Mm-hmm.
I knew his name from My Bodyguard, and I knew his name from Meatballs. I think it was Meatballs. And I remember seeing that name, just growing up without, not really thinking much of it. Just thinking, oh, he's just somebody else. It's not him. Didn't really think too much of it. And then when Gene mentioned it, that he was supposed to star in it as the boy.
Yeah.
Boy. And
that's why his name's in the back of the album. That's why
his name is actually literally on the back cover of the album. Let me see if it's on the it's on the reissue too.
I guess they were serious about making a movie about it. I thought that was just talking shit.
Yeah, no, there was Morpheus. They're literally casting these people, and they went as far as to print his name on the record, on the back cover. And they were that close. I think they were that close. But my problem with them having a movie was that, and I always thought this going back to the outtakes that you had that I borrowed from you and recorded, tape to tape.
Right.
I always felt that if they were going to do a movie, that they should have at least made it a double album. I always somehow felt that The Elder should have been a double record. That's my only problem with The Elder. My problem with The Elder is not what everybody else's problem with The Elder is. My problem is not that it sucks. I think Just the Boy is brilliant. It's mm-hmm. gorgeous, man. It's gorgeous. The chord progressions, that solo, just that foreboding solo, man. That just that unrest. It's just like this sound of like foreboding unrest, man. That you feel like you're in the ship, man. You're going through the dark in the middle of God knows what, you know. And it's I love it, man. But my only problem with The Elder, it's too short. There's not enough of it. It should have been.
Yeah.
If they were gonna make a record, if they were gonna make a movie, the movie's got no chance on it with a soundtrack that's, well, I mean, look, I guess I proved myself wrong because Purple Rain was a single record. So there you go. I just blew my entire argument.
Well, you probably got like The Wall and Tommy in the back of your minds, you know, other concept albums that they made movies out of.
It should have been more sprawling, man.
Yeah.
It should have been even longer.
Now let me ask you a question. You might notice, dude, does Ace do all the guitars? I know he's not pleased with the project at all. Does he do all the guitars on the album?
No, I actually think that Paul does more guitar. I mean Just the Boy, I believe is Paul. I don't know about things like Under the Rose. I'm gonna guess that even Paul did those solos.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I mean, look, I've always said that.
Because I know I read Bob Ezrin just said, had just the guys in Kiss, man. He didn't have a lot of outsiders involved at all when they were making that album. It was like in England somewhere, wasn't it?
Toronto.
Toronto, all right. Yeah, yeah. Gene said something about the dreary weather, and it was just them. Like, Ezrin had no outsiders. No.
Yeah, yeah. Was it either Toronto or Connecticut? They went to Ace. They went to Ace, so the Ace didn't have to come to them. They were pretty much, they're just appeasing Ace,
you know,
trying to keep him in the group at that point. It's either Toronto or somewhere in Connecticut. I don't know. Don't quote me on it. I mean, it's the stuff I used to know. Some of my info fell out of my head over the years.
I think it's Toronto.
Yeah. So where was I going with this? Oh, it was such a good point too. Fuck.
Ace and Session Man, Paul doing the guitars.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you know, it's just that Paul is so underrated as a guitar player. If you listen to the very little bits that he has done with Kiss, I mean, he adds to those solos. You know, he does. I mean, obviously, listen, the ones we can think of. I Want You, the first part of I Want You, the opening of the I Stole Your Love guitar solo. World Without Heroes is Paul. He's very melodic. He's much more melodic than Ace is. Ace is very much technique. Ace never left the basic pentatonic scale. He does very little outside that basic pentatonic, that blues scale. Right. The 1-4-1-3-1-3-1-3-1-4-1-4 scale. Almost everything Ace does exists in that framework. Paul doesn't know scope of what Ace plays in terms of soloing, but Paul is so much more melodic, and he makes those moments on the Elder. But I also wanted to say that I think Gene, and this is probably very unpopular too, I think Gene owns the Elder, man. That's Gene's record. Gene totally shines on that record, man. Think about it. I mean, obviously, you know, the big anthem, I, which is kind of like their anti-drug, believe in yourself type of empowerment song that Kiss has always been. It's always been their message. I Believe in Me. They actually, a couple of years ago, they actually ended the show with that. They paired it with Rock and Roll Over. And I thought it went over pretty well, man. I think they should be closing their shows with it, with that and Rock and Roll All Night.
Did I say Rock and Roll Over? Sure, man.
But all right, World Without Heroes, Only You, and Under the Rose, these two mystical songs, man. It's like it's like you expect Yoda to come out, man. It's like these little bits of like you expect like Obi-Wan Kenobi or like Yoda or you know, it's like it and it's so mystical sounding, man. I think what people feel is hurt Kiss. I thought, man, this is some of the strongest stuff they've ever done. Guys, people, go back and listen to the Elder, man. Don't just hear it. Listen to it. Play it. It's all there, man. It's all there. You've just been missing it, man, because you've been telling yourselves that we're supposed to hate this fucking record because we're real Kiss fans. Well, fuck that. Go back and listen to music from the Elder.
Yeah, listen for it and think for yourself.
Anyway.
Hey, man. How come we know so little about Lou Reed's involvement with them? Is there anything written about how they got together, man?
The extent of that is here's everything I know, which I could basically tell you in about a minute. Lou Reed lived across the street from Paul Stanley, and so did Bob Ezrin at the time. They both, I mean, as far as like their apartments were, you know, we know where Paul lived in 1981. It was in the Upper East Side. Okay. So, I mean, he's a New Yorker. Ezrin's in and out of New York. Okay. So Ezrin obviously is close with Lou Reed. You know, he did Berlin. And he did, he's got a history with Lou Reed. So Ezrin got Lou Reed into the studio for at least a day. I don't know if he worked with them more than a day, but Lou Reed was in the studio with them for a day. And he was just there to write lyrics. Judging by some of the melodies, I think that I would say that Dark Light is a Lou Reed composition. Just
you can almost hear him singing it, man. You can hear Lou.
Yeah, I mean, that's... But it's also very Ace-like too, you know. The almost the way Ace spits out Dark Light is almost the same way he spits out Hard Times.
Mm-hmm.
It's that same just monotone street.
They both got that New York City street drawl, man. I got that similar style, man.
Almost like, and I thought the same thing when Lou Reed put out Set the Twilight Reeling in '96. There's a song called Adventurer.
It's good record. Now, good song.
If you listen to Adventurer, I always thought my first thoughts on Adventurer was that I was like, this is an Ace Frehley song. I can hear Ace Frehley singing this song.
Nah, so the
sensibilities in terms of how they spit words out, Lou Reed and Ace Frehley have always been similar.
in terms accent. Of
style. So, you know, so Dark Light, Lou co-writes Dark Light. Lou also co-writes Mr. Blackwell. And apparently Lou had sprawled out on a notebook. They were just hanging out. They were taking a break. And Gene was sitting next to Lou, and Lou had a notebook out on a table in front of him. And he had written just out of nowhere. He had just sprawled out and said, "A World Without Heroes." Because they were dealing with the hero concept.
Yeah.
You know, which is very basic and very, I mean, it's in every hero story is the same. And you go back to, what, Gilgamesh, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever it is, you know, Beowulf or just the Greek tragedies, Star Wars. It's just very cliche.
That Joseph Campbell shit, yeah.
Any Joseph Campbell stuff, yeah. And Joseph Campbell obviously goes heavy on Star Wars and the power of myth. They were just dealing with that topic. They were dealing with that theme. And so Lou had sprawled out A World Without Heroes on a notebook, and Gene took it and ran with it. And I don't know if he passed it back and forth with Lou in terms of writing the words, if they shared credits on the lyrics, but at least Gene is giving credit to Lou at least for the title. I don't know how much involvement Lou had in anything else. In that song. So World Without Heroes, Mr. Blackwell, Dark Light. And I said I would tell you the extent of what I know in under a minute, but it's been more like 5 minutes for that. But it is
so little written, man. You know, I read that Anthony DeCurtis Lou Reed bio that came out like 2-3 years ago now, like super detailed, like talks about every shit Lou Reed ever took, and he makes no mention whatsoever of his collaboration with Kiss in that book, which I was disappointed in. I thought it was weird.
Because Anthony DeCurtis, good writer that he is from that school of Jan Wenner, Rolling Stone. And it was probably at a time when you just weren't supposed to, it wasn't cool to acknowledge Kiss. It was just, I don't know. I just think that there's just that certain brand of rock journalist that goes back to the Rolling Stone school of it's Kiss.
Yeah,
it's Kiss. Yeah. Really, maybe. Kiss. No, it's.
I'd like to give him more credit than that, but maybe that's on his team, man.
Can I say it again?
I'd like to give him more credit than that, but maybe that's all there is to it.
Give who more credit?
Anthony DeCurtis as a writer, but you know, maybe no, that's
no,
all
no. I don't think. I mean, look, Anthony DeCurtis. Thing. He's very. I mean, he likes all the good artists that we like, but I just think that there's a very. It just goes back to that baby boomer elitist, holier than thou, hipper than thou thing that we were involved in for a while too, man. That, you know, if you don't get it, man, you're just not hip. You just don't get it, you know? You just don't get the read, you know? And it's just a lot of that. And a lot of those critics were the ones who defined what was quote unquote what was real and what was not, man.
Yeah.
And Kiss was not real, man. Kiss just weren't cool, man. And I think it's just nothing more than that, you know. And again, Kiss don't help themselves by trashing themselves, saying, "Oh, we tried this, but we failed. It was a failure, man." Well, fuck you, Paul. You guys created something fucking brilliant, and you're just too uncool to know it.
Yeah, I don't know why I don't own it. I don't.
Huh?
I don't know why they don't own it. Yeah.
You know,
hey, it was a good record and we're proud of it. But, and who gives a fuck what people
think?
But
you're cool. You're cool in other ways, Paul, if you're listening to this.
Yeah, I don't hurt his feelings.
We can.
Yeah, man. Paul's cool, man. Paul aged well. Well, all I ever see about Gene now is him selling his houses. He's selling his house in Las Vegas, and he's sold his house in Beverly Hills, and he's buying a house here now.
Eric texted me recently. Eric, who is Eric, I can't Ford? Stand Gene. Yeah. He's like, I can't stand Gene Simmons. I can't stand, like, all the, you know, because he's never been big on Kiss for like the last 25 years, man. And he texted me about 2 months ago. He's like, "Yeah, man. Gene Simmons is like, he's like really pushing like the vaccine. He's like, he just like really scored points with me, man. I got this weird newfound respect for Gene." was like, and then I texted him back. I was like, yo, well, check this out, man. He just retweeted one of something Michael Stipe said, man. You know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, Gene's been very, well, Gene's always Gene, but he's doing some things out of character that what we come to expect from Gene, I think.
Yeah. Have you seen his artwork that he's selling now? I think it sucks, man. But he's has like silk screens of handguns he's selling for like $500,000. Yeah.
I don't know. I heard that, yeah, he's now suddenly he's a painter, or he didn't tell people that he was a painter. And okay, cool. Paul's a painter. Paul's work. I actually like Paul's work, man. Paul's good at what he does, man. Did you ever see Paul's work, man?
I don't know that I've seen it. I'm really trying to think. I don't know that I've seen it.
He's a little crazy with his colors, like his use of color, man. But man, he can make Jimmy look like Jimmy and Jimmy Page look like Jimmy Page.
Yeah,
he could paint and he can draw, man. Like his stuff is for real. It's like it's legit. He's like, and his self portraits of, you know, just the stuff that he did of himself, man, looks like himself.
Wow.
He's good, man. He's good at what he does, man. I can't say I've seen anything by Gene, but you know, it's these guys got to retire soon, man. And you know, I like Paul's Soul. It's a Soul Station, the Soul record that he made, which a lot of another thing with the Kiss fans, man, is like, oh, this is not in line with being a Kiss fan. This is not cool. We're not supposed to like this stuff. You know, why did Paul have to do this? Get the rocks out of your ass. It's Philly Soul, man. It's Motown. It's good stuff, man. It is great fucking American music. It's the other American music. The American music that's not rock and roll, man. And there's plenty of it. And it's fucking good, man. Kiss fans are missing out if you're not listening to Paul's Soul Station record, man. Hey, it's not mind-blowing. But for dude, the dude is fucking 70 years old, man. It's more dignified than getting up there and trying to sing Heaven's on Fire, man.
Yeah, I think he knows that.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. It's time for them to hang it up. So when is this fucking tour supposed to end? Or is it just open-ended at this point?
Somebody asked Paul the question of, because of the shutdowns, are you guys, is the end of the road tour now going to run into 2023 whereby you hit your 50th anniversary? And Paul basically said, that's very likely to happen, where we're going to be, you know, we're going to acknowledge the 50th, and yes, the end of the road will probably coincide with Kiss's 50th anniversary, man. It's likely not to end until 2023, man, because they've got a whole lot of dates to do.
I haven't seen him in a long time. Maybe I'll go, man. I want to go to a Kiss convention too. I don't even know if they have them anymore, but I'd like
they
to go
have
to
expos every few years.
Did you have that expo?
Yeah. Well, I think they have them every year, where they were having them every year, but I mean by us. On the East Coast, man. I mean, I usually do the New York, New Jersey expos. That's like, I don't travel. I don't travel anymore. I go 45 minutes up to, where was the last one in Jersey in 2018? Wherever it was.
Yeah, I know where you're talking, man. Like, wasn't that one in Kenilworth, man?
It was, no, not it was, Kenilworth. It was one I'm wrong. Of Parsippany. Parsippany, I think.
We went to one in Parsippany.
We went to Boston. We went to Boston. Yeah, we went to Boston. Did we go to Cleveland?
No.
We went to Boston.
I didn't go to Cleveland.
We went to Poughkeepsie. We went to, there was one in Cranford. There was one pretty close.
That's the one I was trying to think of. Cranford, man. That's
the one at the Meadowlands. Yeah, there were so many of them back then. And then they basically started calling them, when did they? I mean, they were called conventions back then. Now they're just another expos. So I guess mission accomplished on this one.
Yeah, bro. Thanks for having me. And I'm not just saying this to plug you to your listeners, but let me know, congratulations on your new book, and let me know how I can acquire a couple copies, man, for sure, right?
You go on Amazon or wherever books are sold.
Wherever fine literature is sold.
Fine literature.